In 2016, Carolyn Coe spent time in Kabul, Afghanistan, as a guest of the Afghan Peace Volunteers. And she's also a contributor to the Voices of Creative Nonviolence webpage. When I spoke with Caroline recently, I asked her first about her background, which led her to Afghanistan.
I have been following the work of Voices for Creative Nonviolence for several years, even when they were under a different name, Voices in the Wilderness. Always admired their work. I guess it was about 2008, 2009, that winter, I decided to go to Jordan and Syria to see what was happening, what was the situation of the Iraqi refugees in those countries. And before I went, I contacted Kathy Kelly, who I had heard speak in Maine a few times, and asked her for some advice because I knew that she and other members of Voices had visited with the Iraqi refugees. And that contact just started a more personal relationship. And a couple of years ago, I decided I really wanted to go to Afghanistan because I so admired the work of the Afghan peace volunteers that Voices had worked with for a few years. And so I contacted her, and she said, well, can you go in a delegation in 2 weeks? And I had just come back from Palestine, and I felt as though I wasn't ready to leave at that time. But I did leave and go on my first delegation to Kabul later that year in December.
I'll just take you back to that first trip to the Middle East, to Jordan and Syria. What was that like?
It felt like a whirlwind. I was there for about 3 weeks, and because I had reached out to Kathy Kelly and Kathy Breen as well, also with Voices, beforehand, I had so many contacts that I was sometimes conducting, as many as 6 interviews in a day, meeting with different refugees. It was exhausting and heartbreaking, and also such a beautiful experience as well, just the generosity and the hospitality, and that's what I'll say about that.
Have you been able to follow up on any of those people you met at that time to see how they went?
I was initially. There was a woman that I stayed with, an Iraqi refugee I stayed with in Amman, Jordan, and a couple years later when I was visiting or entering Palestine through Jordan, I again stayed with her and saw her again. And there was an Iraqi refugee who resettled in California. And for a while, I stayed in contact with him by phone and email. But regrettably, with both of them, the emails that I have and phone numbers I have don't seem to work. So I have lost touch with them and with all of those whom I met at the time.
And your time in Palestine?
I have been in Palestine a few times. My first trip was actually in 2009. I was on a Code Pink delegation to Gaza after one of the bombing campaigns of Gaza. And then I later visited the West Bank, a few times. I would go about every 2 years in the summer, but it's been 2.5 years since I've been to Palestine. And in the times I did go, I certainly noticed a change. My first visit to the West Bank, there were weekly Friday demonstrations in so many parts of the occupied territories. And then by my last visit, there were a few places where they'd have special demonstrations, and a couple of villages still had Friday demonstrations, but the resistance had changed in form, I would say.
You must be concerned about the situation there at the moment, especially with Trump giving the all clear to settlements, more settlement buildings.
Yeah, it's so concerning, but in truth, U.S. policy towards the Palestinians, I don't know if it has ever been good. You know, even when people are in government say, oh, you shouldn't continue to build the settlements, you know, they're an obstacle to peace. Really, the U.S. is not using, you know, its power to make any change there. And until very recently, until, what was it, December, that Obama and through the U.N., didn't abstain or try to block a Security Council resolution against Palestine. So, you know, yes, it's horrible what seems to be in the works now, but I don't know that U.S. policy towards the Palestinians has ever been good.
It's about the same as the government here in Australia, whatever government it is, too. When did you first arrive in Afghanistan?
Let's see. It would have been the winter of 2014, I believe, so December of 2014.
Can you describe the city of Kabul?
What I've seen is somewhat limited. Maybe I should share the parameters of my visit. You know, I'm met by a couple of members of the Afghan Peace Volunteers at the airport, and then we go by taxi for about an hour to another part of the city, and I stay in a house with some students who are Afghan Peace Volunteers. The students are from the province of Bamiyan and are either high school students or university students in Kabul for their studies. So mostly I'm walking between that apartment. Just a couple blocks away is the Border Free Nonviolent Community Center, where a lot of their activities are. So often, I would only walk a couple of blocks to that center and back. On different visits, I have excursions to other parts of the city for one of their projects. You know, this last visit, I went with two groups of Afghan Peace Volunteers to different women's homes. The volunteers were doing a survey to see which families would be selected to sew duvets for a winter comforter project. Raised to see which families seem to be most in need. So I have seen more parts of the city through visits such as that. But pretty much my travel is quite confined there.
Is it confined because of safety?
For safety, yes. I have less movement than, I would say, Afghan women. But as, you know, one volunteer said, one male volunteer, you know, even he doesn't get out so much because the pollution, especially in the winter, is just so horrible. I understand that there were something like 3,000 pollution-related deaths last year. And the air quality is just very poor, especially late afternoon and into the morning. So pollution is part of the issue. Security is certainly a big issue because people always accompany me when I walk or go in a taxi somewhere. And, of course, they're put at risk by being with me. So I don't tend to ask to go to places, but, you know, when I'm invited to join them, I go.
What causes the pollution?
I think in part it's because so many people are living in this city, you know, surrounded by mountains, that the poor air is getting trapped there. And people are burning everything in the winter to stay warm. You know, there few people have the money to buy wood. They may be burning clothes, they may be burning plastic, they may be burning coal. So what they are burning is one source of the pollution, certainly.
We're going to talk about the work of the Peace Volunteers. Can you first tell us who they are and how they got started?
Sure. I know part of the story. So the Afghan Peace Volunteers are a group of youth. Most of them are high school or university level students, although there are some who are even under high school age, I'd say like middle school age. And they come together. They represent the four primary ethnic groups in the country, Pashtun, Hazara, Tajik, and Uzbek. And that in itself is unusual because generally members of different ethnic groups do not socialize or work together. And they work together for three primary goals. They work to promote nonviolence, sustainability, and equality. And of late, they've been concentrating on economic equality, though it certainly also includes gender equality and, you know, equality between the different ethnic groups. So they have a number of projects, including the Duvet project that I mentioned. They have school every Friday morning and afternoon for disadvantaged children, or especially disadvantaged children. There's over 80% unemployment, I understand, in the country. So almost everyone is in need, but it's those most in need that attend the school. Originally, it was set up to be a school for child laborers. One day, or at least half a day, they would come and try to develop literacy skills. They would take nonviolence classes. But it seems now there are still some who work in the streets, maybe selling vegetables or gum, or maybe washing cars, or, you know, collecting sheet metal, something like that. But a lot of the students that I talked to this last visit, they were in government school the other days of the week. They were just trying to get ahead by going to school, you know, an extra day. So that's another one of the volunteers projects.
I'm speaking with Carolyn Coe from Voices for Creative Nonviolence about her work in Afghanistan with the Afghan Peace Volunteers. Are there girls included in this?
Yes, there are girls and boys. And in terms of numbers, I don't know percentage-wise, but yes, the school is largely, and the volunteers themselves, largely represented by girls as well. And each committee for their different projects has, you know, except for maybe Atan, which is a traditional dance that only the men do, and, you know, a soccer club that is only the men, most of them are represented by both girls and boys.
What's the physical dimension of the school, and what resources do they have?
The physical dimension, let's see, it's school is used for other meetings and reasons as well, but on Fridays they have, let's see, maybe five rooms dedicated for classroom space, and there are 50 students who come in the morning and 50 students who come in the afternoon, so they're divided in that way. They sit on the floor. And there's no heat in the building, so it can be quite cold. The sun pouring in the windows helps in some rooms, but if you're on the north side, that doesn't really help. And the students are supplied by the volunteers in the center with a notebook and a pencil and, you know, some basic items, as well as a monthly quantity of some state food staples like rice and lentils and oil and things like that. But the school is pretty basic. I mean, kids on the floor and leaning over to write in their notebooks.
So supplying them with food, is that to encourage them to come to school, or is that to replace the money that they might have earned if they'd be out in the street?
I would say it's both. The food that they receive, the food, you know, is because, I mean, it can vary how much they would actually earn in the street, but it is motivation for the families to allow the children to attend on this day. Certainly, the food is not enough. It doesn't meet all the needs of the families. For example, one mother pulled me out of a classroom on this last visit and was asking me for help. She had not been able to pay the rent for 20 months, and she said that her husband was injured and unable to work. And she said she greatly appreciated the food, but she knew she needed some money for rent. And it really isn't my role to help in that way. So I listened to her, and I said that all decisions were made by the volunteers, not by me.
And where do the volunteers get their finances from?
Voices for Creative Nonviolence, based in Chicago, does a lot of fundraising for the school. I know there are other groups, including individuals in Australia, who have donated funds, and some in the UK. But it has been largely international donors. Interestingly, I learned that, and I assume this is also true in Kabul, but I learned from a woman who worked in Herat that even some of the wealthy Afghans are reluctant to give money to organizations like the Border Free Center, because if it is known that that individual has given, you know, a large sum of money to the school, then, you know, his family members would more likely be kidnapped. So I think the volunteers have been smart, not only for that reason, but also just in promoting the idea that everyone can do something to help, that they're beginning to reach out to local shopkeepers and seeing if shopkeepers will donate, you know, some bags of rice or a certain amount to try to make that food donation sustainable or locally sustainable.
What do the children do at the school, and where does the permaculture sites fit into it?
The children who are studying, it's one of the primary languages of Afghanistan, and they take a math class. They also have a nonviolence class, and the nonviolence class is with all 50 students together. And I've seen some special classes there as well. Some students take a tailoring class. I've seen science class and a little bit of art or creativity. But I think the basics are literacy skills and nonviolence. And, oh, permaculture, yes. Permaculture project was started, I think, in earnest last spring. I was not there at that time, but there was a month-long course for which students got certificates. I have seen some outcomes of those efforts. There's a garden both at the center and at the apartment where I have stayed, and some of the volunteers stay, and they have a third plot in the city. There are some students who attended the street kids school who have also volunteered in the permaculture project, but it's primarily the older volunteers. And I think part of the way that the permaculture fits in is to the idea of promoting sustainability and organic gardening and just growing food for yourself.
Who gets the food?
Last July I saw some children picking the mint from the garden. There wasn't much to harvest while I was there. At the apartment where I would stay and some of the volunteers were, we would eat regularly from the garden, whether it be herbs or tomatoes or hot peppers. So the people living there. In terms of the third spot in the city, I don't know what was harvested from that spot because I didn't visit it either time.
Talk about the duvet project. How did that get started?
I think volunteers saw a need. They saw a need for women to have some work. They certainly recognized how some families didn't have either a stove or didn't have the money to fuel the stove to keep warm in the winter. So the idea was that they would find women from the different ethnic groups and invite them to, or hire them to sew duvets and they would be supplied the materials as well as the transportation money to come to the distribution site to pick up the materials and to return with the finished duvets. So the women are getting some work for at least a few weeks of the winter, and then the duvets are distributed to different parts of the city where people are deemed most in need.
What are they made of?
They are cloth, outer section, like a sheet-type material, cotton. And then inside, they have been stuffed with a polyester wool. But my understanding is that this winter, they were switching to a cotton wool instead. So the stuffing would now be cotton inside instead of polyester. And I understand one reason for the change was that it used to be that polyester was much less expensive than the cotton, and the price has equalized, and that was one reason for switching to cotton.
And how do the duvets reach the women who need them most?
In different parts of the city, there are community leaders. I think the literal translation in Dari is lawyer, but really they're an elder or a community leader. And as long as that individual is respected in the area, the volunteers approach that individual to see who, I believe it's always a he, who he deems the families most in need in the neighborhood. And then those families are given a little piece of paper, and on a set day, there's a truckload of duvets that comes to some location near where they live. It may be a mosque, and they pick up two duvets per family there. There are surveys of the women who sew the duvets, as well as surveys of the street kids, but I don't believe that the volunteers go to door to door for all the recipients of the duvets.
Can you talk about some of the young people and also the women that you've met over the last couple of years and the stories that they've told you of their lives?
Yeah, one volunteer that I've gotten to know a bit during my four visits is Varguna. She lives at the apartment where I stay, so I've been able to spend more time with her than with some of the other volunteers. And she's 24 years old and in her final semester at university studying journalism. I really admire her strength and her openness.
What has she told you about her life?
She would tell me that since she was 5 years old, she would get up at 3 a.m. to make bread and to cook and to wash clothes. And she would work really hard all day until nightfall, and working for her brothers and to assist her mother. And this took her life until she was 18 years old. Her brothers had been opposed to the idea of her going to school, but her mother didn't want her to have the life, the difficult life she had had, and was supportive of Varguna to attend school. And she's really excelled. She studied at a teacher's college for 2 years after finishing her high school studies, and then went to university. And the first year of university, she didn't have to pay any university fees, because if you're top in your class there, you don't have to pay for the semester. So she has worked really hard. One thing that I admire about her is she's so strong. She really sticks to her beliefs, and she's deeply reflective. Her father and grandfather and uncle were all killed, and she told me during this last visit that when the Taliban were about to kill her grandfather, he said, "If you kill me, there will not be enough blood to make mud," meaning that he was an old, weak man. And, you know, what possible benefit could it be to them to kill him? And Zarguna said, you know, I cannot unhear that, or I cannot unsee, you know, that. They killed all three. And as a child, to have that experience, to witness that, it has impacted the rest of her life. And she recognizes that sometimes she's angry and it shows on her face, but she says, you know, I can't do anything about that. I can't avoid it. She doesn't like that she looks angry sometimes, but she can't avoid it. Just the way that she stands up for her beliefs. As I mentioned earlier, at the Border Free Center, people of different ethnic groups work together, and one of her professors who attends the university that is largely Hazara, and the professors as well, the students there of that ethnic group. And one professor was asking her about her volunteer work and found objection that she was working with Pashtuns and Tajiks and other ethnic groups. And so he asked, well, what does your father think about that? Or, you know, what does your father say? And she said, my father was killed by the Taliban. And he said, well, the Taliban are Pashtun. And she said, well, I don't know what ethnic group the people who killed my father were. And she was refusing to have hatred for all people of one ethnic group. The professor continued to deliver barbs, but she cried at the time, but she continued to stand up for what she believed in. And in fact, her best friend at university is of another ethnic group, and both of them, maybe ostracized is a little too strong a word, but they socially, they have found it difficult at the university being friends. Their friendship has been tested in that way. But she's one of the people that I really admire. And then there are just other stories. Like there's Haditha, which is, she's a student at the American University in Kabul. And there was the attack on the university at the end of the summer. And she and other students were there at the time, you know, hiding in their classrooms or in their dormitory rooms. Very frightening experience. Since that attack, the university did not offer in-person classes. They were offering some online classes, but with electricity on only every other day and lack of high-speed internet, she ended up dropping her online class because she just couldn't keep up with the work. And I think many, many students had to drop the classes because, you know, getting onto YouTube and Skyping and all these things, if you don't have electricity or high-speed internet, this proves too challenging. It's my understanding that the school is reopened for classes now. But it was a question for Haditha. You know, she had been staying at the dormitory because her classes were often from 4 until 8 at night. And it's highly unusual for a woman especially, to be walking, you know, at night. So that was one reason she had stayed at the dormitory. But her family was worried about her safety and returning to study there, and they were wanting her to stay at home. So she was having to make the difficult decision, will I do I stay at home and then, you know, travel what is considered late at night there, or, you know, stay in the dormitory. And I'm not quite sure what decision she ultimately made about that. But she said that the university now looked like a prison to her because of the increased security.
Finally, Carolyn, is it people like these women that you've talked about that draws you back? And actually, what is your role when you go?
When I'm there, I feel as though the most important role is to be a listener. I have tried to learn some Dari, so where I live in Maine, it's challenging to study the language when I'm not there. But I think primarily when I'm there, it's to listen. And when I'm asked for my comments or advice or reflections, I certainly share them. to listen, to witness, and then when I return here, to share my photographs and stories with people, especially in my community, so that they, so I can put a human face on the individuals that I've met. I think so often when reporting is done on Afghanistan, people focus, reporters are focusing on some bombing or something related to the military and really neglect the impact that so many decades of violence have had on the population, how it really has traumatized the Afghan people. I don't think there's a person in Afghanistan who hasn't experienced trauma.
I'm speaking with Carolyn Coe from Voices for Creative Nonviolence about her work in Afghanistan with the Afghan Peace Volunteers. And that was Caroline, and great work that she's doing there and working with those very brave young people in Afghanistan and, of course, with the Voices for Creative Nonviolence.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.